ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः ॐ सहना भवतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति 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 In response to a request for suggestions, I believe one of the suggestions that was received was that we should try to understand the different aspects of yoga. Because though we use the expression integral yoga, we forget that yoga itself means integration. There is no non-integral yoga. There is no specialized yoga. It's called Integral Yoga Association. And it makes people feel that there is something called integral yoga, and something else called Hatha Yoga, something else called Raja Yoga, and so on. Yoga means integration. And where there is no integration, there is no yoga. It's some kind of gymnastics or some kind of emotionalism, some kind of daydreaming called meditation. Yoga means integration. The very word means integration. And at least my guru Swami Shivananda emphasized this at every turn, that it is no use trying to develop one aspect of your personality, neglecting others. It won't work. It's not only a question of the wisdom of doing so, it is in practice impossible. You have studied this in connection with the endocrine system. If one gland is affected, the whole system is affected, because it is a closely knit, intricate system of mutual adjustment. So that if your thyroid is operated, everything else is also upset. They may try to compensate for it, they may try to balance for it, whatever it is, you have disturbed the system, not just one link. And as the saying goes, the strength of the chain is in the weakest link. The yogi then studied the different aspects of our personality. And evolved a system that at once develops, simultaneously develops all these aspects of our personality. Not one after the other, not one at the expense of the other. And no specialization is possible here. In this discovery, the yogi found that first of all there is the body, which is the most obvious thing, and the body should not be neglected. this may sound a bit strange to you, because you are not familiar with some of the things I might mention. There have been so-called religious or spiritual people all over the world. Probably they were in greater number in India, because in India everything is in greater number. There were people all over the world who regarded the body as a spiritual obstacle. There have been mystics in the Christian world, especially, who have also adopted a similar attitude, that the body is an obstacle to God realization or a religious life, and it must be punished and it must be tortured, And there were similar yogis in India also, who regarded that the body should not be attended to. The more sick you are, the more dirty you are, the more filthy you are, the more holy you are. Because it is then that you are really proving that you are not worldly. Not worldly, nor egoistic, nor selfish. We have funny stories in India of a monk or a holy man who had running sores throughout his body because of neglect and dirt and filth. And it seems those sores were infested with worms. I hope you don't mind. You had your breakfast? The sores were infested with worms, and it seems sometimes when he was sitting down, those worms would germs, or worms, I don't know what they were, would walk away from him, because there were too many of them on his body. And it seems this man would patiently pick up those germs and put them back. Why do you run away? There is plenty of flesh, more to eat. These things were considered of extraordinary religious merit. These were the ascetics. And asceticism is not bad. We'll come to that. And there were others who believed in raising your consciousness to a supra-physical level. They talked in terms of levels. High-rise building. And with a special elevator for the higher floors. We had an experience yesterday. What is the square called? Allendale Square. If you want to go from floor 1 to 13, you can take the ordinary elevator. If you want to go above 13 to 31, you take another elevator, goes up there and then starts climbing. So they had a special elevator. They were called Jnana Yogis. They said anything below the spirit is danger. Yoga is union of this individual soul with the supreme soul. Don't talk of anything else. So, neglect the body, neglect the mind, neglect everything below this level, 13th level. Shoot up to the 13th. And link it with the God, link it with the Supreme Self or God. You got it. It must have worked for some people. Let's not forget that also. But incidentally, when you find some people for whom it worked, the Indian yogi has a very clever way of rationalizing it. How is it that Ramana Maharishi didn't practice Hatha Yoga? How is it that so-and-so did not have a guru? The orthodox yogi gives you an explanation which is unbeatable. They have practiced all these things in their previous incarnation. You cannot prove it, you cannot disprove it. So the argument ends there, which is a very clever idea. And therefore forget them, look at yourself. Is it possible for you to leap up from the 13th floor and go to the top? It seems to be difficult. Accept it. When the body is sick, you cannot think of God or you cannot think of anything else. Even if you think of God, you are merely praying to God for the health of the body. It's a ridiculous thing, but that is what happens to us. So face it. Why not keep it a bit healthy? So you can avoid all this hassle. Not in order that the body can be kept forever and it can be sustained in a healthy condition even during its tenure of life, but it is part of this total picture. Take care of it. And therefore he evolved the Hatha Yoga. The Hatha Yoga system, the Yoga Asana and Pranayama system took into account the fact that there is a body. I don't know if we could use the expression that we have a body or we are the body, but there is the body, which is part of this total picture. And it has to be looked after. As a matter of fact, one of the disciplines of Raja Yoga is Shaucha, or purity, which the yogi defines as cleanliness of everything. Not only your body, but the environment, your clothes. So that the yogi's vision is total, it is not fragmented. The body is to be kept clean, healthy, and if you endeavor to do so, you will discover that you need to keep your food clean and healthy, your lifestyle clean and healthy, your clothes clean and healthy, your environment clean and healthy. Otherwise, it's not even possible to have physical health. I know of quite a number of people who practice very vigorous yoga asanas and even pranayama. And you ask them, why do you practice pranayama? To clean my lungs and clear my lungs. And so it's all right, very good. But they go on smoking. Their idea being, if the practice of pranayama clears the lungs, well, never mind, if I smoke a few cigarettes, I'll practice a few more pranayama. That won't do, that won't work. Then, in order that we may not forget that there are other things than the body, the yogi also recommended some elementary ascetic practices, which, according to my guru at least, amounted not so much to self-torture, but a simple life. Otherwise, one tends to reach out to an imbalance in one's attitude towards the physical body. The physical body is necessary, but it is not the all. It is not the total picture. So, one should lead a simple life, and therefore one of the disciplines mentioned in Raja Yoga is contentment, santosha. To lead a simple life, but make it clean and healthy. Make the body clean and healthy. Keep the body clean and healthy. And this is the one of the aims of Hatha Yoga. I must mention here in passing that Hatha Yoga is not merely yoga, asanas and pranayama. It's a tremendous lot more. I was reading a very interesting book by an American, Baba Ramdas, giving the biography of his master, a holy man in India who is no more. It seems this master used to say that people only talk of Hatha Yoga, there are no Hatha Yogis now. Because Hatha Yoga is not asanas and pranayama any more than the alphabet book is English. Of course, without the alphabets you can't read English, but that is not the English language. This is merely a primer. Yoga, asanas and pranayama are merely a primer. And taken out of context in isolation, they are mere gymnastics. Once the body becomes pure and the nerves are steady, the yogi looked a little deeper. To see how and where and in what context your physical personality acquired any importance at all. In other words, what are we living for? Is it so important that I should live, which means that the body should be preserved? Immediately he noticed that the body is related to others. Your physical life is interwoven with the lives of others. And at that point, he also discovered that this interrelationship or interrelatedness involved several things. One, our interdependence and our emotional involvement in one another. Our activities are all interdependent. No one is an island in this world. You cannot isolate yourself. As long as you are alive, you are working with others, human and subhuman and superhuman probably. And we are all interdependent. How should we live that we don't create a problem for ourselves or for others? How should we live that we don't make ourselves unhappy or make others unhappy? Is that possible at all? Here we are talking about leading an active life, which is what the body is meant for. The body is meant for leading an active life. And how should this active life be led so that it doesn't become a problem either to us or to others? That in our relationship with other, with people or non-people, we don't become a problem and they don't become a problem. And this whole scheme is called Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga is not what it is often billed to be, service of others, but living in such a way that you are not a problem to others and others are not a problem to you. Is that possible? If that is not possible, you live in a state of tension which destroys the whole structure of yoga. And if that is possible, what should be done? Because here it's a matter of doing. And the yogi evolved the other aspect known as Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga cannot stand as an independent or isolated affair, but it has to be integrated with others as we go on, which we shall go on discussing. Here the yogi examined the whole of the Bhagavad Gita concerns this. Here the yogi examined the three fundamental aspects of action, of relationship. In action, in relationship, there is the one who does something, there is the one to whom it is done, and there is the action. These are the three fundamental factors. If I am talking is a job, is an action done now, I am saying something and it is all directed towards you, and there is the action. These are the three factors, three elements. And the yogi once again pointed out, keep them pure, clean. Free these three factors from pollution. Free these three factors from speculation. Free these three factors from falsehood. Which means investigate them, see. Because if you neglect any of these, if you neglect to investigate any of these, to look into any of these, you might develop problems there. Just as a neglected organ in the body becomes sick. A neglected element in this aspect of yoga might endanger the whole structure. So, first, see something very simple and beautiful here, that you, as well as the person whom you serve or related to, are both made of the same substance. You and the other person, whatever be the service, And whoever be the person whom you serve, you are both made of the same substance. Physically, we are both made of the same substance. The flesh, the bones and the blood and all the rest of it, hair. Whatever be the superficial differences, the chemistry is exactly the same. Yeah? No difficulty here. Whatever be the food you eat, it's all converted into flesh, blood, cells, bone. All of us breathe the same air, there is no difference. All of us think, whether those thoughts are good thoughts, bad thoughts, wicked thoughts, holy thoughts, unholy thoughts, thoughts. All of us have a mind. Where is the difference? The difference arises because we think we are different, which is a thought. As we have said, we all think. And we all think we are different from each other. It's a marvelous thing, which again unites us. We again have something in common, because we all think we are different from each other. That is where the difficulty arises. Whereas, there is this common factor amongst all of us. Physically, we have more things in common than uncommon. The mind, the life force, everything seems to be common. But we think we are different from each other. That is the pollutant. And Karma Yoga was evolved in order to keep this pollutant out. To remember the common factors more often than imagining that we are different from each other. And so, a super common factor was introduced. This might be called God, this might be called consciousness. The yogi, they ultimately realized this as truth, but to begin with, he introduced it as an axiom. That God dwells in all, and that it is that God who dwells in this personality, in this body, in this mind, in the personality, that enables this personality to function and therefore speak. And it is the same God again who dwells in you, in these bodies, in these personalities, that enables you to hear and to understand. This way, the pollutant of distinction is gradually removed. It's not done in a day. We were not even born in a day. We took quite a lot of time to get out. This is the aspect of Karma Yoga. I'm making it very brief. But then, this Karma Yoga depends upon our belief, our faith, our devotion, what we are devoted to. Because I must be devoted to this truth, that there is a common factor linking all of us, that common factor being God. And because of the common factor linking all of us, we love one another. If we are one, we must love one another. Just as the several organs or limbs of the body love one another. And they serve one another without asking a question. Love is merely the expression of the unity that already exists between us. If that is not realized, there is no love. And so, the yogi brought in what is known as bhakti yoga. Bhakti is love. It has been said by nearly every spiritual leader, love one another. But the question again is, it seems to be difficult for me to love another without a motivation. And if love is motivated by a motivation, it is a motivation and not love. If I love you because I love the cause and not you. So, can I love you as long as I have the feeling that you are another? That is the question. So, once again, we must return to this doctrine that we love one another because we are one. Right? But you and I exist as separate beings. Alright? So, we are one in God. Only that feeling or understanding can enable us to love one another, otherwise not. Loving one another in other contexts is fraught with danger and frustration. Because if I love you and you don't reciprocate, I'm frustrated, I'm mad. Even murders take place in such a context. So, I must love you, but I must love you as God. I must realize we are one, which might even mean that we are one in God. I am loving you not as you, but as God. And thus, the emotional aspect of my personality is trained to participate in this total picture of yoga. My body, my active nature have all been trained in the yogic spirit, and now the emotional aspect of my personality must also be brought in to participate in this total yogic process. And that is called bhakti. Now the problem is, how to love you, and not to love you, but to love God in you. Or recognize that we love each other because we are one in God. This is a whole complication. It is then that your emotional aspect also can be trained properly to integrate with the rest of your personality in yoga. How to love God in you? How to recognize that in God we are one? How to recognize that we love each other in God? What is God? It is possible for some to rise instantly to the 31st floor by recognizing the omnipresence of God. To many of us, it may not be so easy. To many of us, it may not be so easy. And therefore, the wise sages introduced innumerable rites and rituals, innumerable routines, innumerable methods and techniques to train, to awaken in us this love of God. As someone very beautifully said, if you have never loved one, you do not know how to love all. If you have never really loved one, you do not know how to love all. That sounds like a full stop, doesn't it? There is a danger. Again, if you put a period there and conclude the sentence, then you are stuck with this one. You love this one and you experience love, and that's the end of the story. But you are stuck. You are imprisoned in that one. Whereas, the original formulation was, in order to love all, you must learn to love one. Why must I love one? In order to experience what love means, so that I may love all. But here I am. I love this one and I feel that I'm quite satisfied with it. I'm imprisoned. That's one of the reasons why now it's coming more and more into the open. Even in this man-woman relationship, it is becoming increasingly evident that you can't love one, you get bored. Whatever that means. It means this, that love is not meant to be restricted to one. The heart in which God, who is omnipresent, dwells, cannot be confined to one person. You may love your husband in one way, and you may love your brother in another way, you may love somebody else in a third manner. But love cannot be confined in that way. It has to break all bounds, break all bounds, break all bonds, and express itself in innumerable ways towards all beings on earth. Where it is constricted, it becomes painful. Loving one is meant merely as a stepping stone to love all, loving all. In order to love all, I must learn to love one. But the goal is not loving just that one and confine myself to it, but to expand my consciousness. Even so with religion. Mahatma Gandhi, I believe, once remarked, and I heard it from the person to whom this remark was made, that if you have never ventured into the field of another religion, a religion other than into which you were born, you will never know God. Because you remain confined in that, quite self-contained, satisfied with this little love. And little love is no love, it's imprisonment. How to love God? God in all. How to ensure that I love you not as you, because immediately there is going to be a cause. I love you because. Only if I love God, who is omnipresent, can this motivation be kept aside how to love you as God. And so this God was introduced. And the emotional aspect of our being was trained to love God. And what is that God? In order to help us in this search, the yogis evolved innumerable techniques, methods, rites, rituals all over the world. Even in those religions where God is not considered an image, they have also got their own rites and rituals, their own concepts, their own what I might call mental images, psychological images. Because man needs them. Swami Vivekananda once remarked, I believe, that man has never worshipped anything but an image. You cannot worship the omnipresent being. You cannot love and adore the omnipresent being. It's difficult. And if some have done, that is only because in their own previous incarnations, they adopted the other techniques and methods and had trained themselves. We might use some image, some even idol, if you want to call it so, or some symbol which represents God, and through which we might train our emotional being to experience the love of God. Incidentally, if this does not appeal to us, we might land in unpalatable soup, because there is an emotional being in us, emotional aspect of the being in us, and it demands expression. I must love. And I cannot love an abstract thing, an abstract being. So if you prevent me from worshipping an image of God or a symbol of God, then I will worship something else. It may be a girlfriend, or it may be money, it may be power, it may be position, or it may be film stars, or soccer matches. There is this emotional being aspect which is pumping, jumping, pumping in order to find an expression. One must be very careful in dealing with it and channelizing it Godward. Prayers were evolved. Japa of a mantra was evolved, worship was evolved, all in order to bring about one little experience of the love of God. If I have had that single experience of the love of God, then it is possible for me to love each one of you, all beings, as the manifestations of God. Again, a word of caution. This, what may be called idol worship or image worship, worship of an image, is meant as a sample to lead me on to this cosmic worship, cosmic love. The love of one is merely a stepping stone for the love of all, not to be treated as an isolated event or an isolated experience. Even so, if I go to the church, if I go to a temple in order to worship God there, it is not to be mistaken for bhakti. Love of God is not to be confined to the church or the temple, to the image or to an ashram or a meditation room, but it is meant as a sample which should be tasted and experienced everywhere in all my relationships. Now that aspect of my being also has been trained. Then there is another, a deeper aspect of my personality, and that is spiritual. How to find myself in all this? I am serving, I am practicing yoga, I am worshipping God, I am loving all, I am serving all, but I have still not understood who this I is. I have still not actually discovered that there is this divine presence within me, though I accepted it in the beginning as a doctrine or as an axiom from a teacher, from a leader, from someone who knows. In order to discover this inner reality or inner truth, they evolved what is known as Raja Yoga or the meditation techniques. Through deep meditation, we entered into the innermost self to discover that something which is beyond the me, which is beyond the ego sense. Because it is at the level of this ego sense that there is a thought that I am different from you. However much I struggle with what is called karma yoga, with what is called bhakti yoga, I am still only speculating that you and I are one. Or I am intellectually rationalizing that you and I are one. I have not actually experienced that you and I are one. That experience is possible only if I am able to transcend the ego sense and to get deeper into myself, into the innermost self, to see there that this is the truth which is beyond the ego. Aha! If that is the truth here, that the same truth exists there in you. This ego's transcendence or transcendence of the ego is the crux of the whole yogic process. If that is not been achieved, nothing has been achieved. All there is exercise. So they evolved this beautiful system called Raja Yoga, which blended with all the others. I cannot meditate unless I love God. I cannot love God, I cannot love you if my heart has not been purified and if I had not learned to serve all of you. In the faith that you and I are one in God. That was only a faith, not an experience. That faith which enabled me to serve you now leads me deeper within myself into the innermost recesses of my being to discover the faith as true, as reality. And that is Raja Yoga. And the discovery of the oneness of the self is Jnana Yoga, or the ultimate experience. With the help of these, the yogi endeavored to integrate our personality, the body, the dynamic aspect of our being, the livingness of our being, the emotional aspect of our being and the spiritual aspect of our being, eventually leading to enlightenment or self-realization, which is of course yoga in essence. None of these things can be practiced in isolation. Nor even, though it is commonly held that it is possible, stage by stage. It is not as though I can practice Hatha Yoga now and then come to Karma Yoga sometime later, and Bhakti Yoga sometime later still, and so on. Because one involves the other. I cannot love you without serving you. I cannot serve you unless I love you. And I cannot love you and serve you unless I have the faith, at least, if not the experience, that you and I are one in God. And I cannot merely bluff myself that you and I are one in God, but must experience it through deep meditation and ultimately direct experience. So all these are interrelated, and therefore it is called integral yoga.